Homage to the Buddha, homage to the Dharma, homage to the Sangha. Good morning, friends. I'm doing a little talk today about... The title is Excesses Such as Greed. And I want to start with a couple of disclaimers. I'm going to be talking about my own process of discovering my own food addiction and how I have worked with that over the last few years. And I want to stress that I am not an expert on addiction, food politics, dieting, or nutrition. And I'm not going to be talking, hopefully, very much about any of those things. I'm going to be talking about my own personal experience with this issue. And I'd like to keep the talk focused on the Dharma of it, not any of those other things which I have found interesting but not necessarily helpful to my journey. So when I've brought this up in conversations with people, the discussions have gone all kinds of different directions. And I'm going to, because everyone has opinions and everyone has, you know, this is what works for me. And so I am not in any way making necessarily recommendations or giving advice to anyone else. I am just talking about this is something that has worked for me and some of the things that have worked and some of the things that haven't worked, and hoping that y'all can maybe get a little something that might be helpful for you or not. At the end of it, I might just say, forget everything I've said. I think that was Nyogen Senzaki used to say that, so I think that's maybe not a bad thing. But in any case, I'm going to start off by saying this is my background with this. My father was an alcoholic. My mother was codependent and sugar sensitive, and I'll talk a little bit more about that in a little bit. I am a teetotaler, which means that I don't do alcohol. I don't do drugs. I've never done tobacco or caffeine. I don't have any of the usual addictions that people usually think of when they talk about addiction. So I've always considered myself quite virtuous. However, there is this little problem with sugar, which I have dismissed and laughed at and thought, eh, no big deal. Lots of people, everybody eats sugar, right? But I've noticed that I've had blood sugar problems, which sometimes leaves me dizzy or weak, and at odd times sometimes. So I made a few changes over the years and just tried to adjust as best I could. So I didn't eat sweets first thing in the morning. I would eat them with protein so that, you know, it would sort of dilute the problem with it. Sometimes I would try to minimize it. Occasionally, I would get so shaky and out of whack. It was really clear that my blood sugar was out of whack that I would do a sugar fast for at least a day, and that would help reset my system. And over the years, I have watched myself binge on cookies and other sweets at various times. I once ate an entire box of Mystic Mint cookies. And I probably, if I'd had another box handy, I probably could have gone through that one as well. So I paid attention to, I've noticed this for some years, and I've tried to kind of work with it in various ways. So one of the things that I did was I worked with the precepts a little bit and that sort of path of practice that we use with the precepts, and I have used cookies as an example when I've talked with other people about that arc of practice, So like at the end of the day, we do recollection practice where we sort of, you know, this is what happened during the day, kind of draw it through the mind and just see what happened. And I would often sort of wince and say, yeah, I ate 4 cookies today, or I ate 8 cookies, or I, whatever I did. And eventually I'd got to where it was like, oh, you know, right afterwards I'd say, see, there's another cookie you just ate. And then sometimes you'd notice it during the, you know, while you're actually eating it, and then sometimes maybe even right before, and you might still grab it. But the idea is to keep getting farther and farther back to where you can start looking at how does it arise, what exactly is that hunger, what's really going on there, and to find a place to stop and make a different decision. So I kept trying to work with that over the years, and sometimes I could do that and a lot of times I couldn't. And rather than really getting down on myself, I would just say, okay, this is still hard for me, I'm just, you know, and just kind of keep working with it, keep keep having some persistence with it. One time when I recited the Kyoji Kaimon, which is our list of precepts, I saw how my out-of-control eating violated every single one of the precepts. Didn't change my behavior, but it did let me know this is a practice issue. So I've been looking at this for some years. 2 years ago, I started working out at the gym where the Carlsons have been going for several years, partly inspired by their glorious example and the good results that I have seen with them from doing that. My goal was specifically not to lose weight, but to increase my strength and flexibility. And then right after I started there, I broke my wrist falling downstairs. And so I went in with my arm in a splint. But I kept working out. I didn't let that stop me. We did whatever I could do as my physical therapy and so on came back. And one of the things I noticed pretty early on was that my trainer started doing things, and she said, this is also for balance. And I hadn't even thought about balance. But if I'm falling downstairs, maybe I should think about balance. So that's been interesting. The last couple of years, a couple of things happened. So a year and a half ago, I got a blood test that showed me as pre-diabetic. And I thought, ooh, this is maybe not such a laughing matter anymore. I went online to see what medical authorities might have to say, and what they suggested was that I do a diabetic diet and that I lose weight. Bummer. So cut out white flour and white sugar and white potatoes. Potatoes, not potatoes, please, anything but that. But I did it for a while. I really focused on complex carbs. I really focused on getting rid of the sugar. I didn't focus on losing weight because I know from my own experience that that's not a good focus point. But I did pay attention to how much I was eating and what kinds of things I was eating. And then I saw a Facebook post about kids and sugar and how sugar is actually kind of considered a gateway drug, that it activates opioids in the brain and that it is actually an addiction. And that turned on a light for me. It totally resonated with my experience with sugar, which is that it's not so much something I am choosing to do. It's not something I could necessarily point to as a character flaw, but something that just, I mean, like my hand would literally just sort of shoot out there at it and grab it, and I would know that I wasn't hungry. I mean, I had done a lot of work, and I knew I wasn't hungry, so I put my hand on my stomach and think, no, I am definitely not hungry. I'm going to eat the cookie anyway. So there's something else going on there, and an addiction and the business about the brain chemistry started making a certain amount of sense to me. So I went online again and did a little more research, and I found this author, Kathleen, I don't know how you pronounce it, Desmaisons. She's a PhD, and she wrote this book called Potatoes, Not Prozac, which is a terrible title. But her idea is to heal people through diet. So here's her hypothesis that she started out with. There is an inherited biochemical condition called sugar sensitivity that has predictable and specific effects on the brain and on a person's behavior. The foods a sugar-sensitive person eats and when they eat them will affect them profoundly. Sugar has the same pain-killing and euphoria-stimulating effect in the human body as opioid drugs do. These drug effects of sugar are heightened in sugar-sensitive people. Sugar addiction, like drug addiction, is real and can open the gate to other addictions. So there's your gateway hypothesis there. And then third, changing what sugar-sensitive people eat and when they eat it can have a profound effect on their well-being and behavior. So I read this whole book. She has a program. She has the whole, you know, and she's done a lot of research about why, about, you know, looking into all of this, and that's where she got her PhD, was working on that kind of research. And it makes a lot of sense to me. I don't follow her program exactly. It doesn't exactly work for my particular, the way that we do things here. Like, I started out trying to eat protein right after I got up, and then coming to do Zazen, that doesn't work very well. So I decided that getting up for me means at the end of Zazen and service. Then we eat breakfast, and there's protein in it. So that I had to modify a lot of things. So I don't know that I would accept everything completely that she says, but I found that it was useful for me, and that there were aspects of it, some of it I was already doing. There were aspects of it that were helpful for me. And I think mostly it had to do with just a verification that there is something going on that isn't just me somehow being weak-willed. I wanted to read this part because I kind of enjoyed it. So the author has an informal way to diagnose sugar sensitivity. So here's what she says. When a client comes to see me about compulsive eating, I start by asking a simple question. Imagine you come home and go into the kitchen. A plate of warm chocolate chip cookies just out of the oven sits on the counter. Their smell hits you as you walk in. You do not feel hungry. No one else is around. What would you do? People who are not sugar sensitive respond by saying, oh, I go check the phone for messages. Or, I go upstairs and put on my sweats. Some will stop and think about whether they would eat some cookies. Others might say, with no emotional charge, well, I might try one. People who are sugar sensitive laugh at the cookie question. Their bodies are already responding to the very idea of the cookies. They know they would inhale a cookie, probably more than one at that. They might eat the whole plateful, even if they weren't hungry. For a sugar-sensitive person, hunger is not the driving motivation. What triggers their desire to eat is the smell of the cookies, the anticipation of how the cookies will feel in their mouth, and the warmth and sweetness of the melted chocolate. Is anyone like having trouble with this? Even the feeling of having the cookie in their hand will have a powerful association for them. These cookies mean love, they mean comfort, they are friends and lovers. People who are not sugar sensitive think this response to the cookies is strange, perhaps even stupid. What are you talking about? Why would I eat a cookie if I wasn't hungry? The people who are sugar sensitive always know exactly what the cookie question means. I have asked this question of many, many groups. Each time I've received dramatically consistent reactions. While one part of the group will be waiting for the punchline after I ask, would you eat a cookie? All of the sugar-sensitive people are laughing. I totally related to that question. I was one who totally started laughing when I read that question. It was like, you know, before she even got to the punchline, I was like, oh yeah, I know what this is. I know exactly what this is. So that was useful, and she has a more formal way. She's got a whole grid with more questions, and if you answer so many yes and blah, blah, blah. I mean, she's got ways to really sort of diagnose it, and it didn't matter. I mean, it was real clear to me that, oh, yeah, this she's talking about me. One tricky thing, though, about food addiction is that you can't stop eating food. I mean, we kind of need to do that. We need to eat. So then what? I wanted to make sure that this wouldn't be punitive, that it wouldn't be harsh. I didn't want to go into deprivation because the feeling of deprivation just makes me hungrier. So I had to really think about how to do this carefully with wisdom and compassion. And so I called on my practice for that. I've done a lot of work in the past on compassion, particularly discovering that I needed to turn it to myself first. On judgment, just sort of noticing whenever judgment comes up and my own self-criticism comes up. I've learned to sit with all kinds of uncomfortable, painful, overwhelming emotions. I've done a lot of crying silently in this zendo on the cushion. It was all pretty difficult, but it had some benefits. That practice has allowed me to know that I could survive more than I thought I could. It helped me practice with that first noble truth of suffering and dissatisfaction, to accept that suffering does exist and simply sit still with it, not having to change it immediately, not having to push it away, not having to like grab onto something else to fix it, but simply to sit with what is here. It gave me practice in stopping when difficult emotions come up during daily life. And I might just mention that this sounds easy, and it isn't. Learning to do it on the cushion is practice. taking it into the daily life is much more difficult, or I have found it much more difficult on all kinds of levels, just in terms of something comes up immediately and, you know, there's this instant reaction going on, and learning how to stop in the middle of your daily activities is useful and difficult. So I brought the same principle to my hunger cravings. I noticed them, I sat still through them, I realized that I could survive them without doing anything about them. And again, it's easier to do this on the cushion away from any food than downstairs when there are cookies on the table. Still, it is practice. So I had an experience somewhere along the line in here. I went to a church breakfast in Vancouver as a part of the gay marriage campaign there with the Communities of Welcoming Congregations. And, you know, church breakfasts are usually set up pretty similarly, and the church ladies are all there, and we have this nice long table, and it has pastries, and it has fruit, and it has granola, and it has beverages. And so I went through the line. I managed to not have any pastries. I had some fruit. I picked up some granola, which turned out to be highly sweetened. Oh, well. And then over here, there's two more tables, and there's a table with all kinds of different meats on it, sausages and chicken wings and I don't know what all else. And there's another table with all kinds of sweets on it. I looked at the meat table and thought, yeah, I don't eat meat. Eh, no biggie. I looked at the sweets table, and it's like dragging me over there. And I'm thinking, really noticing the difference in my response there, and thinking, what do you suppose it would take to have my reaction to the sweets table be the same or similar to my reaction to the meat table? And one of the things that told me is, I work with that with the mind. I mean, there is a physiological thing going on, but there's clearly something with the mind where I'm perceiving it a certain way, and maybe I can change how I'm perceiving it and how I'm reacting to it. So I began to experiment different responses to these feelings of hunger. The habitual thing is simply to deny that it's there. You are so not hungry. And the problem with that is that that is denying my own experience, my own truth, and it's an old habit of mine of disconnecting from my own feelings and my own body. I've noticed that even eating even a very small amount of sugar sets up cravings. It can number one, it can throw my blood sugar out of whack, but it also sets up these cravings for more sugar, more and more and more, to the point where there's no satisfying it. In the past, I noticed I started eating a chocolate chip cookie at 3 o'clock in the afternoon every day, and even doing that once, the next afternoon at 3 o'clock, I had a huge craving for a chocolate chip cookie. So there's these habitual things that get set up, but there's also, it somehow just creates more of that craving. That helped me to realize that a feeling of hunger might not be telling me the truth. That is, maybe I don't really need food right now. Maybe I don't really need sugar right now, which I had already suspected. But it gave me a way of thinking, maybe I can just ignore it for now. What if I just sort of put it off for a while? Still honoring and accepting that there is that feeling, but saying, I don't have to satisfy this right now. Again, it's easy on the cushion, not so easy when I'm in the kitchen and I know where the cookies are. But started doing that. And what I discovered from that was that cravings don't really last all that long. And I've read some things about that. Estimates vary anything from under a minute to 17 minutes. I don't know where they came up with 17 minutes, but basically, if you have a craving like that, and then you check in and you sort of say, okay, maybe later, and you check in 5 minutes later, you're likely to find that it's gone. That, I had that experience several times. Craving was gone. There wasn't any more feeling of hunger. I was fine. I was like, isn't that interesting? It's just not necessarily true. Another strategy was substituting. Instead of eating a cookie, I'd eat an apple. I'd get a glass of water. Sometimes I'd just take some deep breaths. What happens over there in the Dharma house is I'm usually working in the office upstairs. At some point, I need to go downstairs, either to write somebody's name on the meal calendar or to put something in a mailbox, and there's the kitchen right there. So the habitual energy was go in and get a cookie and have a little snack. So those are things that I had to work with, just looking at my habit energy. So I started changing what I did in the kitchen. Sometimes I would clean something. That was a good thing, good substitute, right? And after a while, I realized maybe all I have to do is look at the kitchen. Yep, there's the kitchen. Yep, I know where everything is. Go back upstairs. Maybe not do anything. So, you know, playing with that, really kind of changing how that works. I've noticed that different kinds of sweets have different effects, at least in my body. So I can eat a certain amount of honey. I can go overboard on honey too, but I can eat a certain amount. It doesn't set up the same effects. Fruit doesn't seem to cause a problem for me. So certain, you know, just sort of really paying attention to what's going on with that. And then finally, really paying attention when I do eat, appreciating the food, noticing its virtue in my body, noticing how it tastes, how it feels, really like enjoying it. And because otherwise what happens is I'm just sort of shoveling it in, and then I end up, my stomach is full, but my mouth still wants more. So that gets into mindful eating. This is another thing I found online, and some of you have probably seen this. This came out in 2012 in February about, it was a New York Times article about mindful eating and kind of some of the ways that that's been working with it. And I want to read a few things out of that article. Try this. Place a forkful of food in your mouth. Doesn't matter what the food is, but make it something you love. Let's say it's that first nibble from three hot, fragrant, perfectly cooked ravioli. Now comes the hard part. Put the fork down. This can be more challenging than you imagine because that first bite was very good and another immediately beckons and you're hungry. This experiment in eating, however, involves becoming aware of that reflexive urge to plow through your meal like Cookie Monster on a shortbread bender. Great image. Resist it. Leave the fork on the table. Chew slowly. Stop talking. Tune into the texture of the pasta, the flavor of the cheese, the bright color of the sauce in the bowl, the aroma of the rising steam. Continue this way throughout the course of a meal, and you'll experience the eye-opening pleasures and frustrations of a practice known as mindful eating. Mindful eating is not a diet. It's not about giving up anything at all. It's about experiencing food more intensely, especially the pleasure of it. This is anti-diet, says Dr. Jan Chozen Bays, whom we all know, a pediatrician and meditation teacher in Oregon and the author of Mindful Eating, A Guide to Rediscovering a Healthy and Joyful Relationship with Food. She says, I think the fundamental problem is that we go unconscious when we eat. So notice that. It's a good thing to pay attention to. What's going on? I've gone through meals and suddenly realized I hardly tasted this food. I was so busy thinking about the next thing that's going to be happening. So paying attention. It ends, the article ends with some possible chilled out gestures and rituals that you can put into your regular calorie intake. So the first one is, when you eat, just eat. Unplug the electronica. For now, focus on the food. Those of us who live here have regular opportunities to do that because we do a fair amount of that. Our breakfasts are formal and silent, and we often have times when that's all we're doing is just eating. And doing that, and during a retreat that we have, that is what we do, silent, formal eating. And it's quite an eye-opening experience if you haven't experienced that before. Consider silence. Avoiding chatter for 30 minutes might be impossible in some families, especially with young children, but specialists suggest that greenhorns start with short periods of quiet. Even young children can sometimes manage for a minute. So it's like any practice. You know, you start with something small and you kind of move up a little bit. Try it weekly. Sometimes there's no way to avoid wolfing down your onion rings in your cubicle. But if you set aside one sit-down meal a week as an experiment in mindfulness, the insights can influence everything else that you do. I like this one. Plant a garden and cook. Anything that reconnects you with the process of creating food will magnify your mindfulness. Chew patiently. It's not easy, but try to slow down and aim for 25 to 30 chews for each mouthful. And finally, use candles and flowers. Put them on the table before dinner. Rituals that create a serene environment help foster what one advocate calls that moment of gratitude. So that's the appreciation part of it that I was talking about. And I don't always make it, but I cultivate that. I try to remember that as I'm eating, to really appreciate and notice the food. So I'll talk a little bit about the stages of change. This is something that I got from a workshop I did at the prison from one of the chaplains, did a workshop for volunteers. And I might not have it exactly as she presented it, but I think it's probably pretty close. The first stage is not even thinking about it, complete dismissal. Sugar's not a problem for me at all. It's just, you know, it's just how things are and whatever. The second stage is beginning to think of it as maybe a problem that should be addressed. Well, yeah, that's kind of not so good, and I should probably do something about it. The third stage is making a plan to take some action. So I kind of got to that point finally. I mean, I would sort of done a few things, but I finally, you know, it really was a dramatic shift when I got that blood test result and sort of went, oh, this is serious. I need to do something and start making some real plans. And then the fourth one is actively working to resolve the problem. So that's when you're actually doing something. And the fifth one is evaluating, reassessing, reviewing, changing your plan and action as needed. And what happens is that we tend to go back and forth among these different stages as we're kind of moving forward. This model of stages of change works for all kinds of things, and not even just addictions. I mean, I think the illustration she used was smoking, but it can work for a lot of things. And of course, you know, what she was aiming at was criminal activity. So there are things that can go on there, too, where this could actually be useful. I talked recently with an inmate at Columbia River Corrections Institution about, because what he said was that he had solved his addiction problem and found sobriety by using the Dharma. He found that more helpful than the 12 steps programs. And he'll use those too, but he finds that the Dharma is more helpful to him. And I was curious about that. I asked him about it, and he says, well, it has to do with the Four Noble Truths. He said, addiction is rejecting life. It's looking for something outside of ourselves to solve the problem. And it is the opposite of the Four Noble Truths. So if you really work with the Four Noble Truths, the first one, just accepting that the fact of suffering, of dissatisfaction, simply accepting that it is there, recognizing the causes of the suffering, which is trying to grab onto something or push away things, recognizing that there is, in fact, a way through this by following the Noble Eightfold Path. So I looked at the Eightfold Path, and I saw that several of them really have something to do with this right view or right understanding, which is part of what I've been doing, is gathering information, investigating how does this work. Right intention, certainly, so making vows of various sorts. Right speech, right action, you know, how I behave. Right effort, definitely, and right concentration, so bringing that mind of meditation and concentration to this particular issue. And right mindfulness, certainly, about being mindful with my eating. This last summer, I went back to the doctor and got another blood test, and it has gone down enough to be back in the normal ranges. I've lost, at that point, a little more than 10 pounds. During this last month, during the holidays, I've put a little bit back on, but the 10 pounds are still gone. So something has something has shifted long-term, which is my goal. I wanted this to be a long-term change. I didn't want it to be a quick diet, get rid of some pounds, and then put them all back on. My regular workouts at the gym have, in addition to my initial goals of strength and flexibility, improved my balance. I can really feel a difference there. I didn't know my balance was bad until I started working on it, and it's gotten better. My stability and my stamina. So, success, right? At least so far. And yet, this vigilance continues. And I think anyone who has dealt with any kind of addiction of this sort finds that that is the case. There are still days when I can tell that I'm eating too much, and there are still times when I give in to sugar. I'm still looking at the effects of various foods on my physical well-being. Processed grains, grains in general, carbs in general, various fruits and vegetables. I've been emphasizing protein, still trying to reduce overall, and pay attention to how much eating I do is because of hunger, and what kind of hunger, and how much is just habitual. I have to keep the balance of compassion and persistence. That is an ongoing question, not just sort of falling into judgment and punitive behavior and attitudes. I have to not be attached to losing a whole bunch of weight. And it's really exciting. You know, when I get on the scale, I think, look at that, that's great. I want to do a whole bunch more, you know. I have to be really careful about that, not getting too attached to that, and just sort of say, oh, that's really nice. That's good. Keep it up. And honoring the body as it is, absolutely as it is, recognizing its perfection, and recognizing the fact that I am, in fact, still aging. Various things will continue to deteriorate no matter what I do. All I can do is maybe slow some things down and maintain the highest quality of my life as long as I can. I feel like I have a responsibility to do that, to live my life for the Dharma as fully as I can, as long as I can. I want to end with something that is only tangentially related, but I just felt like I wanted to share it. This is a death poem from Yogin Steve Stuckey. And I just wanted to share it. He starts out talking about the body, which is, of course, a lot of what I'm talking about here. This human body truly is the entire cosmos. Each breath of mine is equally one of yours, my darling. This tender abiding in my life is the fierce glowing fire of inner earth, linking with all pre-phenomena, flashing to the distant horizon, from right here now to just this. Now the horizon itself drops away. Bodhi Svaha. So, comments or questions about all of that? How do I do?
I was kind of curious if you could talk a little bit more about that practice of giving yourself compassion. Like, what kinds of things did you have to give yourself compassion for, and how did that inner dialogue, what did it sound like?
Whew. Well, I spent a couple of years pretty intensely working on that. I had this wrong view. This is why right view is a very important part of the path. But I had this view that I was the most evil person on the planet. And that was one of those places that I could go very, very easily and very quickly, no matter what was going on. If I made a mistake, it was because I was this terrible, terrible person. So, and then I would feel terrible and I would want to kill myself. Not, I wouldn't want to kill myself, but I wanted to die. I wanted to die. I felt like I didn't deserve to live. So, when I started realizing how deep set that was and my own fear about all of that, I began to realize, well, then what I have to do is turn compassion inward to myself. I have to pay attention to who I am right here, right now, You know, where this became clear was Kerrigan suggested that I put, because I realized that some of this came from my, you know, as a tiny child. So he suggested I put a photograph of myself as a child on my altar. And I started throwing up. I mean, I could not do that. I just couldn't even go there at that point. So I thought, whoa, I'm in trouble here. So I started paying attention to myself. Metta practice is great for this. If you've ever done any of that, you start out by saying, may I be free from danger. May I be safe. May I be at ease. May I be at peace. May I be healthy and happy with physical and mental well-being. So you start there. With metta practice, we always start with ourselves. So what I began to realize, I needed to do that for myself right then, you know, as I am right now, right here. And I did just that for the longest time and started noticing when this judgment business would come up, when I would start doing this, you're the most horrible person on the planet kind of thing, and how that process worked. And it was like I started realizing I'm just sort of going down this cliff. And once I actually start going down there, I just have to ride it down to the depths of despair and just sort of sit there for a while. You know, so I did a fair amount of that and just kept noticing that, and it took a long time to start changing that pattern. But I brought a lot of that to this so that I wouldn't just go right back into that pattern, because it was a pretty well entrenched pattern. Does that help?
Yeah. Hi, thank you. I work as a translator at home, so my office door to kitchen door is about 8 feet.
Right.
And I have been noticing that oftentimes I like sit at the computer and then I say, and then stand up and go to the kitchen and nibble on something or whatever. And it doesn't feel quite right. And I really thought about why do I do that? Why is there some kind of sense of lack there when I'm sitting at the computer? And it's like, then one thing I noticed was that to me eating brings me back to body sensation. Mm-hmm. Because when I'm at the computer, I'm all about here and cerebral really, and somehow it becomes uncomfortable after a while. But I don't know how to. The easiest way is to just eat something.
Yeah.
And
it's the way I see that is it's a transition device, so that, and I find that when I'm working on the computer that at some point, okay, I need to stop doing that and I'm not sure what I'm doing next, and there's this kind of like weird time where I'm not quite sure what to do. That's when I play a game of solitaire or something. I think it does a similar thing. It changes your mind state so that it kind of resets some things so that you can then start fresh again. And eating's definitely, I mean, if the kitchen were right next to the office, I'd probably be in worse shape, because at least I now have to go downstairs to go to the kitchen.
So then what
I do is I'll do the computer games, because at some point my brain isn't going to work on this one anymore. I have to like do something different, and that's a way for me to kind of clear that out. So I'm guessing that's part of what's going on there.
Yeah, so what I devised was that I bought various kinds of, what are they called, like exercise tools.
Uh-huh.
And I made a setup in different parts of my house.
There you go.
To, you know, step on something, uh-huh, or, you know, hang on to this like a ring thing, or, you know, I have to go to downstairs to do that, but that does help.
You could do like Kakumyo and set your desk up so that you're standing and like doing exercises while you're on your computer.
Oh, actually, I tried that too. Uh-huh. I tried to.
There's a lot of ways to
set up everything up high, mm-hmm, and enjoyed it for a while. But then I started to have some kind of like leg problems
from
just doing that for hours.
Right.
So I started to do these things, like I can do it for a short time, okay, here and there, and you know, several parts of my
the
house.
The important thing is to keep noticing, which is what you're doing. Noticing what's happening, how does this work, what's going on when you're doing this, what are some other strategies that you could use, and that's what you're doing. You're coming up with some other strategies, and that seems to be the important thing about this. It's sort of the process of how do you work with Yeah. Something you notice that's beginning, you're sort of beginning to realize this isn't quite working the way I want it to work.
Right. And in my case, I think it seems like I really like feeling bodily sensations.
Right.
That's why I like swimming, or I used to run. It's always about feel, like if I can feel the body sensations, mm-hmm. then I'm happier. Mm-hmm. And that's really lacking. I mean, even sitting sometimes, I feel like, weirdly enough, I feel like when I'm doing really well, it's like I'm feeling I'm doing some kind of exercise, and I'm like, okay, get going.
Right.
And then I can do it for a long time. Uh-huh. But
so that's the thing about tuning into the breath and the body while we're sitting on the cushion, is sort of getting that that habit energy of, okay, you know, I'm sitting here. Oh, yeah. I mean, because it's real easy to start. You know, I remember one day I did a Zazen Kai, 8 hours of sitting. After 7 hours, I was looking outside, and I thought, I don't even know what the weather's like out there. Is it sunny? Is it? What's going on? And I thought, well, what's going on right here? Oh, I'm sitting here. 7 hours before I could finally tune into my own body right here in the room. And it was just interesting to notice how often that happens, that our minds are just, who knows where they are, bringing them back and really focusing on the body sensations, and particularly of the breath or whatever's going on. Yeah, very important.
Yeah.
Mr. Mindfulness here. Oh, different guy.
Do you think that there's any purpose in realizing or being mindful of the ultimate purpose of eating, and that is simply to fill up the gas tank? I'm thinking of cultures that really have very little variation in mm-hmm. the food that they eat. They mm-hmm. just maybe have dal and rice every day of their lives. Mm-hmm. And the idea of having food for pleasure is just not something that's on the radar screen. And I wonder if being more mindful of that aspect is helpful.
Yeah, I mean, you know, the traditional admonition is eat when hungry, sleep when tired. And the excesses such as greed, many of you will recognize as from our five thoughts, a third of the five thoughts. We regard it as essential to keep the mind free from excesses such as greed. We regard this food as good medicine to sustain our lives. For the sake of enlightenment, we now receive this food. That's how it goes on from there. So yes, it's very important to just realize, and I've started to do that, to realize, okay, I had this great meal, but I enjoyed it, but it's done. My body's feeling good, and now I can go back to work and do what I need to do. And it's not a big deal on some level. So one of the things that sometimes we will do with Buddhist practice, not so much here, although we do oatmeal for breakfast every day, and you know, so we kind of get out of that whole sense of it has to be something fancy or whatever. But there are places where they do have the same food every day, or they really pay attention to it. One of the things we did at Tassajara at one point was kind of funny. The abbot had us pack lunches. On days off, we would pack lunches. He had us pack lunches for other people. And the idea is that then you get a lunch that somebody else has packed that doesn't take into account your own preferences. So then you just eat what's there. And that's a good practice, you know, to pay attention to that. So, and you know, obviously at that point you're looking at, you know, your reaction to the food. I don't really like this, and why did they do that, and whatever. I mean, you know, and that's all fine. But just to recognize this is just food. It's like something that needs to happen in the body, and it still has the virtue in the body, and all of that. So, yeah, I think that's a good point. Yep. Kyogen up here. Okay. Yeah.
So I want to ask you a question. It's about greed, but not about food.
Uh-huh.
Okay. So I have a negotiation this coming week about a company that I'm starting. Part of what we're going to talk about is salary. And I find that when greed arises in my mind, I have one mindset that's very like business. This is what I deserve to get paid. I want this much money, this much equity. And another mind that's, you know, I care about mindfulness and helping people, and to bring money in at all, it just taints everything. Mm-hmm. And I feel like I'm trapped between the greed mindset and the pure mindset. Mm-hmm. And I'm longing for integration. So I'm curious if your experience with food has allowed you to have some understanding how to integrate two mindsets, one of greed and one of purity.
Well, our second precept talks about stealing as having a thought of gain. So I've often liked that way of doing it, and that you know, the mind and its object are one. So we're not needing to gain anything. And yet, as you say, when we're in this business of business, in the business of business, it has to do with what do we need. And with food, it's like, what does the body need? Okay, so we could certainly get by with, you know, dal and rice and vegetables for every single meal. You could. And yet, there are some benefits to varying that, to doing something extra, to doing something a little different. So I think you just have to keep... I would keep them separate, personally, you know, because I know that sense of, I'm doing... what about teachers, you know? I'm doing this because I love it, because it needs to be done, and it feeds me on some level all by itself without any of that, and yet we have to make a living, right? We certainly do that here in the West as a temple. So, you know, in the East, they have it all set up where other people support them and they don't have to even think about it, theoretically at least. In this country, not so much. We have to have a system. We have to have pledges and we have to have fundraisers and we have to do all this stuff. We have to actually ask people for money. So are we selling the Dharma? Good question. So it's not, I don't know that it's easy, but I think the way I would work it kind of practically is to keep those two things separate.
Thank you.
And I'm going to get Kyogen in here. Last one. He gets the last word. This is always a good thing. Yeah.
Actually, I had two quick things. One is just responding to I can't see you, but responding to this last question, I take an opposite approach to what Kenko just said. For myself, I spent a lot of time avoiding asking people for money and sort of supporting the temple myself, and you know, kind of inviting people to sort of help. But I realized that I was robbing them of the opportunity to own the place, to take ownership for it to be theirs. It became important for me when I saw my disciples coming up that, wait a minute, we have to have a culture where we're supported. If we don't have that, I'm not giving the people who come after me, I'm not doing right by them. So I actually think that that all ties together, that there's a way to sacrifice some of your own financial gain for the sake of the enterprise if you're starting this business. But you must notice that the artisan is worthy of his time and effort, and you don't want to sell the product short or that people don't appreciate it. So it's part of the whole thing. The other thing that I would say about greed and food is there's another saying. It's in Japan anyway, maybe in China. It says, three parts of a full stomach support the man; the other two support his doctor. And
yes.
I think there's a lot of wisdom in that, and in particular because a lot of times we don't feel full, we don't have the sensation of feeling full, at least psychologically, until a few minutes after we stop eating. I remember this as a kid, maybe in high school, I was called away from the table to answer the phone, and I still felt like I wanted to eat some more, but I got on the phone, I started talking, and then I realized, I'm not hungry. And so when stopping a little short and allowing that three parts to be the three parts is a useful practice.